When I'm president, unlike Barack Obama, we will keep this country safe.
That's not what your colleagues say, Marco Rubio, down in Florida.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is your broadcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, and 106.7 FM KSO in Cozy Cottage Grove, out in Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI in lovely Lancaster, out in Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui, up in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. And of course, coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Nashville, and many other fine affiliates, including Radio Sputnik, 5 days a week. I am Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. Yes, it is, of course, as ever, another thrilling action-packed adventure right in the middle of primary season, following Iowa, previewing New Hampshire, all of that and more ahead. Plus, we've got a mayor that we will be talking to shortly. You're going to want to stand by for that. But we've got some breaking news here as we go to air. Rand Paul is out. Rand Paul, the Kentucky senator, is suspending his presidential campaign, he says, to focus on his U.S. Senate seat. This, according to CNN and Politico on Wednesday, he's suspending his campaign. He says it's been an incredible honor to run a principled campaign for the White House. In a statement, he said, "I will continue to carry the torch for liberty in the United States Senate." He, of course, had struggled to gain traction within the crowded Republican field this year. He finished fourth, however, in the Iowa caucuses. Now, that's not, you know, terrible, frankly, in a field of, what, 15, 16? I don't know how many are in it now, but he finished fourth, not bad, except he had only 4.5% of the vote there compared to the top three vote-getters on the Republican side in those caucuses, Ted Cruz, then Donald Trump, then Marco Rubio, each in the 20s. So really, even coming in fourth, he wasn't even close, at least in Iowa. With a debate coming up, I believe, on Saturday now for the Republicans in New Hampshire, prior to the New Hampshire primary, first in the nation primary on Tuesday, Rand Paul hasn't gotten enough support in the polling nationwide to qualify for that Saturday debate. Rick Santorum is also reportedly suspending his campaign today as well, though Santorum had been the reported winner of the Iowa caucuses finally back in 2012. He failed to get anywhere this year, placing just about dead last among the more than one dozen Republicans vying for support at the Monday GOP caucuses in the Hawkeye State. So Santorum is out. Paul is out. Come Tuesday, we've got New Hampshire, and we'll see who is out thereafter. So that is some breaking news, a bit more breaking news concerning the Democrats and their debates. This had been on again, off again, but it looks like it is now on again, this new debate for Thursday in New Hampshire. And if it happens, of course, we will be covering it the following day. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have now agreed to not just this new debate on Thursday in New Hampshire, but to four more debates, beginning with this one on Thursday. Both campaigns have agreed to that, as well as three more, says the Washington Post. After the Thursday debate, they will square off again in Flint, Michigan, The city facing, obviously, a public health disaster due to the contaminated water there. That'll be in March. They'll also debate in Pennsylvania in April and in California in May. Oh, hello. So that has now been agreed to. It looks like Bernie Sanders' hardball negotiating tactics may have paid off, may have underscored that, yeah, you know what, he's maybe not a bad negotiator. He had said he did not want to appear in just one this week, as the Clinton camp had agreed to. He said, no, I'm not going to do them on an ad hoc basis. We'll have more or we won't, and they won't be on weekends or holidays, etc. And it looks like he's gotten his way. The DNC confirmed to The Hill that they will sanction these four additional debates, and that will allow them to, the candidates, to appear without triggering the previous party provision that would have barred candidates appearing in unsanctioned debates from appearing in future official ones. So the agreement triples the number of remaining debates left on the calendar on the Democratic side. The original calendar had called for only two more debates, one in February and one in March. So there you go. More debates coming on the Democratic side. And a lot of Sanders had been calling for more debates for a long time. Clinton was not calling for them. But now that she's not doing quite as well in the polls, at least in New Hampshire, she's more interested in mixing it up with Bernie. And frankly, why shouldn't she be? She does. She seems to do very well. She has done very well in these debates so far. So there's that news. I talked a bit about concerns of various fraud and dirty tricks on the Democratic side up in Iowa on yesterday's program. And as Sanders supporters have been very concerned about what they saw in a few videos, we discussed some of those briefly and the infamous set of coin tosses that all went for Hillary, etc. So we discussed that in very general terms yesterday with Iowa caucus expert Professor David Redlosk of Rutgers. Very informative program, if you ask me, and a fun and funny one as well. If you didn't hear it, you can always download our programs at bradblog.com or over at iTunes. In any event, Professor Redlosk's take on those matters was largely that he didn't see anything of tremendous concern, that much of it was sort of stuff that happens in all close elections that you only notice when the results are really close and you get in there and you pay attention to what's going on. And in particular, in caucuses, which are a rowdy affair even when they go well and when they're run, in this case, by volunteers across the state of Iowa. That was his opinion, his, you know, just one person's opinion. And as I noted, sometimes it takes a while for these concerns to come out, more details to come out, for sometimes concerns at all to come out as we learn about more and more incidents. Well, I've heard from a few more folks since yesterday's show about their concerns in Iowa and about my conversation with Redlosk. And by the way, you can email me at any time. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. Anytime, with any thoughts on any show or any of this stuff that we cover here or that you think we should cover, feel free to drop me an email. Anyway, I hope to talk more about some of what we saw in Iowa with another guest this week in more detail and before the New Hampshire primary coming up, which, frankly, I am much, much more concerned about what goes on in New Hampshire in their primaries for a number of reasons, a number of reasons that folks at bradblog.com may be well familiar with by now. Remember when Barack Obama was winning in every single poll for days and days and days and weeks, really, before the New Hampshire primary, and then Hillary Clinton ended up winning? Yeah, well, that took up a lot of oxygen at bradblog.com back in 2008. Oh, was it that long ago? Man, I'm old. In any event, it did ultimately lead to a full recount on the Republican side, a partial recount on the Democratic side, held by a Dennis Kucinich back then, because of those concerns that we detailed at bradblog.com. So, yeah, lots of reasons to be concerned about New Hampshire. We're going to talk more about it later this week, and as I say, more about what happened with Iowa and the Democrats. But on the Republican side, in regard to Iowa, I had noted yesterday that there hadn't been a lot of concerns out there yet, even though I had a concern about what happened to the voting rolls in Iowa. Some of those who had caucused in 2012 on the Republican side were suddenly not on the rolls on Monday night. So just another reminder, if you think you're registered to vote in Iowa, you might want to check that to make sure before November, because they had a terrible Secretary of State there, a guy by the name of Matt Schultz. He is out now, and I don't know about this new guy if he's any better, but Schultz was one of those Republican voter fraud fraudster dudes claiming there was massive voter fraud going on, of course, by Democrats, and he had to do something about it. And, you know, all his, I think he was there for 4 years, he was able to find, like, nothing. Maybe 10 incidents of voter fraud, none of which were the kind that Republicans claim is going on all over the country, you know, by Democrats. The type that is requiring them to put in photo ID restrictions to keep people from voting. And in the case of Iowa, of course, we know it's to keep Democrats from voting, because when on the Iowa caucuses, the Republican Party doesn't need the permission of the state to set any rules they want, essentially, and they chose not to require photo ID to participate in the caucuses. So, you know, all they care about is keeping Democrats from voting. So never a bad idea to make sure you are registered, and registered for the party that you think you are registered for, particularly before the primaries, if you hope to vote in those primaries. Okay, I got to finish. What I was saying was that, yes, we now do have new concerns, some fairly legitimate ones, about a couple of things that happened on the GOP side at the Iowa caucuses on Monday. And Donald Trump, who had previously conceded to the reported winner, Ted Cruz, on Monday night, is kind of reversing that. He is now calling the Iowa caucuses stolen. Yes, his words. So I'm going to take a look at that a little bit later in this show, I hope, at those specific charges and see if there is anything to them. And guess what? Between you and me, there might be. I'm just saying. So stay tuned for that. Meantime, also, we now have our first polling out of New Hampshire since the Iowa caucuses on both the Democratic and the Republican side. The first poll of New Hampshire that includes some data collected after the Iowa caucuses showed only slight movement on the Democratic side between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. The University of Massachusetts Lowell tracking poll released today shows that Sanders still has nearly twice the level of support of Clinton. This three-day tracking poll included responses taken the day before, the day of, and the day after that Hillary Clinton was said to have won the Iowa caucuses by just the tiniest of margins, 0.2%, I think is what it was. So we're seeing very little change, at least according to this poll, which now shows Sanders with 63% of Democrats in New Hampshire and Clinton at just 30%. Huge, a huge difference between Sanders and Clinton, but little change since before Iowa. No wonder she wants some more debates suddenly. So that's on the Democratic side. That wide margin continues at the moment anyway for Sanders. We'll see if that changes before Tuesday. On the Republican side, a little bit more of a change. We see Marco Rubio, who came in third, now gaining in the first New Hampshire poll since Iowa. This is the same University of Massachusetts Lowell tracking poll. So only one day from this three-day tracking poll came after the results, after Marco Rubio showed up in third place and declared himself the winner of the entire thing, kind of the way he behaved. Let's see here. It still shows Trump at 38%. And Cruz at 14%. The previous poll also showed Trump at 38, with Cruz reported at 12%. I'm sorry, he had been at 14. Now Cruz is at 12. So Cruz has lost a couple of points, whereas Marco Rubio has slowly gained a few points in this poll. Let's see, Rubio, He got consistent gains over the week. He had 8% on Monday in the polling, 10% yesterday, and then 12% today. So Marco Rubio is moving on up. He is He would like you to believe, and there is some evidence now, that he is gaining momentum in New Hampshire and might be the new favorite of the so-called establishment candidates out there trying to vie against Cruz and Trump. So we need to follow him a bit more closely. Rubio, for some time, has thought that he is going to be the president. Here he was last week, and Desi, you say there are no repeats in this clip, right? You've just pulled these together, this montage.
Yeah, this is a montage of Marco Rubio from the GOP debate.
From the last GOP debate in Iowa. Marco thinks he's going to be president, apparently.
Because when I'm president, unlike Barack Obama, we will keep this country safe. When I'm president, we are rebuilding the U.S. military. When I'm president, that will change. When I am the president of the United States of America, and when I'm president, we are keeping ISIS out of America. When I am president of the United States of America, when I am president, and when I'm president, as president, I'm willing to say or do anything in order to get votes.
Okay, so there you go. He is, he's going to be president. We need to get ready for it. So let's look at him a bit closely, I guess. We discussed this a bit last week in one of our Green News reports, but some 15 mayors in Florida, these would be elected officials who are colleagues of U.S. Senator from Florida, Marco Rubio.
And constituents.
And constituents as well, you're right. 15 mayors in Florida wrote a letter last week asking to meet with Rubio, their own U.S. senator, because they are very concerned about his pretty enormous flip-flops on issues like climate change, specifically on climate change, specifically in the state of Florida, where, to say the least, that is a very important issue. So anyway, those mayors are now calling him out, calling out Marco Rubio for being in favor of action on climate change years ago back in Florida, before he decided that he wanted to run for president and was now against action on climate change. One of those mayors will be joining us next right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. So, welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Way back in prehistoric times, back in 2005 and 2006 and 2007, as then Republican Florida Governor Charlie Crist originally came to power in the Sunshine State, climate change and global warming were a big concern in the state of Florida, even amongst Republicans, if you can believe such a thing. Not only in Florida, of course, but all across the country back then for Republicans. As you may recall, even Sarah Palin, when running for vice president with Republican candidate John McCain back in 2008, even she was promising action on man-made global warming. In Florida, of course, the concerns were as large or larger than anywhere else in the U.S., as the southern part of the state in particular was and is on the forefront of rising seas thanks to global warming. Back then, of course, in the 05s, 06s, 07s, 08s, even Republican state officials like then-State Senator Marco Rubio had very serious concerns about rising seas and global warming and had wanted to do something about it. As the Naples News noted last year, quote, after Charlie Crist was elected governor, he convened a summit, appointed a task force, and helped usher in new laws intended to address the future of climate change and rising sea levels. Crist and the Republican-dominated Florida legislature at the time set goals to reduce emissions back to 1990 levels. The initiatives involved so-called market-based solutions to the problem of carbon pollution and would have included a Republican-backed cap-and-trade program as part of the effort. For a brief shining moment, Florida was among the forefront of state-level climate actions at the time. But alas, as the paper notes, The effort didn't last long, and in a short amount of time, the state with the most to lose from a warming planet became a symbol of the polarized debate now surrounding climate change. When current Republican Governor Rick Scott came to power initially in 2011, everything began to change. Efforts to curb emissions in the Sunshine State and otherwise mitigate the worst effects of climate change were rolled back on the state level. Last year, as you'll recall, we talked about it on our Green News Report and on this program, it came to light that the Scott administration had actually instructed employees to no longer even use the terms climate change and global warming in public discourse and in official documents. That led to this fairly hilarious, were it not so disturbing, exchange during a state legislative hearing where the matter was brought up and where Rick Scott officials were asked about climate change but were terrified to even utter the words.
Are you familiar with the new procedures that FEMA issued just this week dealing with climate change?
My understanding is at this point is it will require that future versions of our mitigation plan will be required to have language discussing that issue.
What issue is that?
The issue that you mentioned earlier regarding
climate.
That is pretty funny, but that is actually what's going on in the state of Florida and other ones where Republicans are now arguably banning the use of the words climate change, global warming, even sea rise. So with the lack of leadership from the state government down in Tallahassee in Florida, the burden of climate change itself, which you will be shocked to hear, doesn't actually concern itself with politics. The burden of climate change is now shifted to municipalities, where local officials must deal with the issue, whether ambitious politicians hoping to not to offend the moneyed fossil fuel industry who they rely on for their campaign funding, whether they like it or not. Presidential hopeful Marco Rubio, for example, has now simply turned to ignoring the ongoing problems already facing areas of Florida, where, as Grist noted last week, some already have to wade through seawater to get to their car in the morning in areas of Florida. But where Rubio now simply denies that man-made climate change is even occurring. At a recent campaign event in Iowa, Rubio said that as president, he would not support policies to address climate change, arguing that such policies would destroy the economy, especially since, as he has said now many times, the climate has always changed. There's never been a time when the climate has not been changing.
The climate's always changing. It's always been changing, and it will continue to change. The truth of the matter is that we are not going to eviscerate our economy or set back economic growth or impoverish people to pursue policy agenda that will have a devastating impact on the economic lives of millions of Americans.
So, against that backdrop now, 15 mayors of municipalities across the state of Florida have sent an open letter to Marco Rubio seeking a meeting to discuss these matters. In their open letter that was published last week, they write, quote, "As mayors representing municipalities across Florida, we call on you, Senator Rubio, to acknowledge the reality and urgency of climate change and to address the upcoming crisis it presents our communities," adding that our cities and towns are already coping with the impacts of climate change today. Joining us now to discuss all of this is Mayor Cindy Lerner. She is a former state legislator turned mayor of the village of Pinecrest, Florida, in Miami-Dade County. Mayor Cindy Lerner was first elected as mayor in 2008, was reelected in 2012. She's also the chair of the National League of Cities Energy, Environment, and Natural Resources Policy Steering Committee. The village of Pinecrest sits near the very tip of South Florida, about 10 miles south of Miami on the Atlantic Ocean, just 3 feet above sea level. Mayor Lerner is one of 15 mayors who recently published that open letter to former state legislator turned Florida U.S. Senator turned Republican presidential candidate Marco Rubio. Mayor Cindy Lerner, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you. All right. In your note, in your letter to Senator Rubio, you and the other mayors note that sea levels in South Florida have already risen about 8 inches over the past 100 years. They're projected to rise another foot in the next 35 years, potentially wiping out some $4 billion in coastal real estate, among other concerns. And you also note that with another 3 feet of projected sea level rise, the loss would dwarf that number and result in large sections of the Everglades, the Florida Keys, Miami metropolitan region being completely underwater. These concerns are very real to you guys, even already, are they not? What impact? I know that, you know, in South Florida, you're already dealing with these impacts. So what impacts are you seeing right now on a daily basis, much less, you know, long-term climate change concerns?
So we're already experiencing extreme weather events mm-hmm. on a much more frequent basis. And our infrastructure was never built to contemplate addressing the capacity needs that we now find ourselves in. The stormwater drainage plans have all got to be revised on a fairly regular basis. Mm. And the cost of the injection wells and the pumps and raising our streets is far beyond what any of our cities or even counties are capable of doing. In fact, I just reviewed our state legislative budget requests mm-hmm. going to the Florida legislature, which is currently in session. And there are, I believe last year there were about $1 billion worth of requests for water drainage and it's under the category of water projects, about $1 billion worth of requests. The Florida legislature allocated about $70 million to mm. address those needs, and then our Governor Scott vetoed more than half of what was allocated, the $70 million allocated. So we are literally drowning here in South Florida and have no leadership clearly at the state level and have to rely on our next president understanding the risk that we and the other coastal communities all over this country are facing.
When you talk about injection wells, just so people understand from, you know, the rest of the country in towns that aren't dealing with this every day as you are, when you talk about injection wells and raising the streets, what does that mean? What are injection wells and why do you actually have to raise the streets? What is actually going on right now that is a concern to you, to your drinking water and so forth? And again, not something that's way down in the future, but something that you've got to deal with right now.
Right. Yes, we are living it. Many areas of South Florida, not just the coastal areas, mm-hmm. but the interior parts of many of our cities and our counties are at sea level. And in addition to the extreme weather and having rain events that we built our infrastructure relying on a certain level of service, some of which was an average of about a 25-year storm, a 10-year storm level of service. We're now having rain events on a regular basis that are considered a 100-year storm, meaning you don't expect those storms to come more than once every 100 years, except now they're coming several times a year. Mm. And the same thing, we have cities that have built their infrastructure at sea level because that's our ground level, mm-hmm. but we have a very porous geology that the peninsula of right. Florida was built on, and it's like the limestone is like a sponge.
Right.
So as sea level rises, it not only comes up on the coastal areas, it comes up from underneath where we live, and it comes up into storm drains and floods. It comes up into the well fields where we have, many of us are still living with septic tanks. So these public health urgencies just grow more and more frightening every year.
What was the reason that Rick Scott gave for vetoing those, you know, what money that the state legislature was willing to invest to mitigate? What was his reason for the veto? And basically, what has been his reason for rolling back so many of the program? I mean, Florida was really, you know, began to be a leader under the previous governor, Charlie Crist. You know, they began to be a real leader on climate change issues. So what is the reason that he has given to the people of Florida? And what was the reason for his recent veto of funds trying to mitigate these very real, not hypothetical issues you're having to deal with in your towns and municipalities?
Right. Unfortunately, we weren't really given reasons. It was his staff that went through and just kind of crossed off the list many of these very well-documented and urgently needed water projects. This year's request totaled about $750 million. We will be vying for our desperately needed funding of these requests, mm-hmm. with the governor's expectation that he will be able to accomplish $1 billion in tax cuts this year. So that's what we're up against, is a governor who prefers to give more corporate tax cuts. Of course, the incentive for corporations to want to come to Florida, mm-hmm. diminishes significantly when they understand that we're drowning. So
yes.
The governor needs to understand that too, that he can cut taxes, but he's not going to be able to attract more corporations to want to make their home in a state that is literally drowning.
I had thought, actually, you know, we've been covering green issues on here on the broadcast, on our Green News Report, for many years, and I had actually thought that there was a possibility that once it became clear that we were actually talking about real estate being wiped out in coastal areas, that cost, to so many wealthy people, that would somehow ring alarms for these Republican officials, because we're talking about billions and billions of dollars of potential losses to these communities. But that doesn't seem to have made any difference either with guys like Rick Scott and Marco Rubio and so forth.
The state of Florida has unfortunately been stagnant in its economic development initiatives, and we have relied for decades on development and tourism, and those are the major focus for bringing in revenue to the state. Since we don't have an income tax, it's property tax and it's all the development. And the development is being fueled by a lot of foreign money, especially in South Florida. Mm-hmm. These billion-dollar high-rise condos are being financed by mostly cash from China, from South America. They're coming in and they're just building. The financing is for foreigners to be able to park their money, and from our developers' standpoint, it's take the money and run. So nobody wants to talk about the reality of where these buildings are going to be in 30, 40, 50 years. What I think is going to be the game changer is when the insurance industry and the mortgage industry come in and start declaring their unwillingness to give 30-year mortgages or to insure properties.
Yeah, indeed. Insurance companies are already looking at this. They are not climate change deniers. They are looking at this and knowing that they're going to be left holding the bag for a lot of this. I'm speaking with the Honorable Mayor Cindy Lerner, Mayor of the Village of Pinecrest, Florida, down in Miami-Dade County. In your letter, Mayor, with the other mayors to Marco Rubio, you wrote that in 2006, Rubio had acknowledged the reality of climate change and promoted solutions, including energy efficiency measures, tax incentives for renewable energy and alternative fuel. You said he supported hybrid vehicles because they save money, quote, while reducing emissions and helping to curb global warming. That was in 2006. What do, as you see it, Ms. Mayor, what changed between 2006 and now for Marco Rubio and really the entirety of the Republican Party at this point? What has been that change? It has not been that long since guys like Rubio and even Sarah Palin and, you know, Mitt Romney and so forth were calling for action on climate change.
Right. Well, it was a growth of campaign finance contributions and a very obviously aggressive strategy by the fossil fuel industry to move forward with funding the campaigns of Congress, of the U.S. Senate, in a very deliberative way, and now we're faced with the consequences of that.
Do you think it's as simple as in Senator Whitehouse has specifically pointed to the Citizens United decision in 2010 as the moment when things changed from, Republicans who supported doing something about climate change to the time when they suddenly, all of them, to a man and woman, it seems, became deniers? Do you think that it was really it, just the change in the way our campaigns are financed following Citizens United in 2010?
Well, I think that had a significant, that was exponentially a flood of money, which has made it increasingly difficult to counter with the reality and with science. And the other aspect that I think has been ignored, intentionally ignored, was that there actually is a very vibrant economy in energy efficiency and renewable energy that doesn't get the commercial attention that it deserves. So, you know, part of what Marco Rubio and all the Republican candidates who are in denial, it's really part of just a campaign strategy, an ideology that ignores the reality of the consequences that we're facing, but also the green economy that exists. I mean, look at what's going on in Germany and in other parts of Europe where they have these vibrant economies that are based on renewable energy.
Aside from the obvious, well, at least obvious to you and me, aside from the obvious improvements to the economy that can be seen in taking action on climate change, what do you and the other mayors who are dealing with the very real costs of climate change now and the effect on your economy, What do you think when you hear a guy like Marco Rubio in that clip we played earlier talking about taking action, devastating our economy? I mean, it seems like it's devastating your economy, your towns and other towns like it down there in South Florida to not take action. Your heads must be spinning when you hear that from your own U.S. senator.
It's beyond disappointing. It's really disgusting to listen to somebody that we well know he knows better. And he's just reading from a script that he thinks is going to help him get into higher office. And I can't believe that that will be the case, that we've made too much progress in the current administration. We cannot afford to go backwards again.
What are you specifically asking for from the senator, from Senator Rubio, beyond a meeting, or what would you ask in such a meeting? And has he responded yet to your letter from yourself and the other 15 or so Florida mayors?
He has not yet responded. And what we want is a dialogue. What we'd like is to be able to share with him the reality of what his current constituents in the state of Florida. He is our U.S. senator, although he's been totally absent as a senator from the state of Florida. He needs to be educated mm-hmm. and informed and advised on what it is that needs to be done to protect the country, not just the state of Florida, but particularly because we are ground zero. We are the canary in the coal mine, so to speak, of what's going to be happening throughout the United States. And he needs to stand up and lead on these initiatives. Our current Congresswoman, who's a Republican, Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, who served with him, mm-hmm. Serves with him now mm-hmm. in Congress, has recently signed off on the Gibson Resolution, which was a Republican-led initiative in Congress that actually does acknowledge the realities of climate change and takes a position that Congress needs to act on it, both to mitigate and to provide support for infrastructure upgrades.
It's amazing that you guys have to write an open letter to get the attention of your own U.S. senator while he's up there meeting, one-on-one virtually with voters
right.
in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and you guys are begging, to have a meeting to discuss how to save the lives of your own residents. It's remarkable. Finally, Mayor, amidst the shift, I know there's been this shift I talked about from state now to local and municipality efforts to deal with global climate change. And it's amazing to even say that you have to deal with global climate change at this point on the local level because the state ain't offering you a lot of help. Despite that, President Obama has recently hailed the efforts of four counties in South Florida as a model for the country. Can you explain what that coalition has done to win the praise of the White House and what other efforts are being done, beyond the state level where you're not getting the help you need?
Sure. Yes, we're very proud of what we've accomplished in Southeast Florida. We have what is a template, actually, at the regional level for approaching the challenges that we face. Palm Beach County, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe counties, which comprise over 4 million residents, probably much more than that by now,
mm-hmm.
Came together in about 2010, I think it was 2007 or 8, mm-hmm. where we first came together, and created a climate compact. And under that compact, they brought in our academic institutions, they brought in federal agencies such as NOAA, and agreed to the science of climate change and agreed that we would establish a set of standards and projections. We would model and we would meet on a yearly basis to update ourselves and share best practices. And then a couple years later, created a climate action plan. And in that climate action plan are 110 recommendations for steps to be taken to protect our infrastructure, to better inform our residents, and to move forward in a collaborative fashion to go after more regional needs that are either at the state or at the federal level that we would be approaching together. So as a result of that, we now have cities and counties that are doing our vulnerability assessments, and we are using new technology where we have modeling and projections based on LIDAR mapping, so we know where the highest risks are, mm-hmm. and we are trying to advance projects, as I said, trying to get state funding
right.
for some of these infrastructure projects. And we're coming together with legislative initiatives, both at the state and the federal level, that we lobby for as a region.
It's remarkable that you guys have to take this effort on largely on your own in so many respects, and have to beg the state to help you out. And of course, you know, when we're talking about the people you're talking to, you would think they would understand that the sooner you start, the cheaper it will be to deal with these issues. Just amazing. Mayor, I wish you luck with yourself and the other mayors you're working with down there on this effort. There's a lot of, you know, we spoke during the Paris, UN Paris talks with some of the folks representing the low-lying island nations. They, too, referred to themselves as the canaries in the coal mine, just as you do concerning the municipalities in South Florida. Lots of canaries in the coal mine, and I suspect too many coal mines. That might be part of the problem. Honorable Mayor Cindy Lerner of the Village of Pinecrest, Florida, down there in South Florida, good luck to you, and please stay in touch as this moves forward. I'd like to continue to talk to you guys and see if we can get things moving in the right direction down there.
Thanks. We appreciate you taking the time to focus on what we're doing.
You bet. Our pleasure. Mayor Cindy Lerner of the Village of Pinecrest, Florida. Okay, a quick break, and we are back with more broadcast as Republicans charge Republicans with fraud and a stolen election in Iowa. That's straight ahead. Stay tuned. That song makes me think of Goodfellas, which may be appropriate here. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I mentioned at the top of this show that we're going to be talking a little bit later this week about some more about the concerns that I know a lot of Sanders folks have about the way the results came together in Iowa on Monday at the caucuses. So we'll be talking more about that as the week goes on, and about the New Hampshire primary coming up next Tuesday, which everyone should be quite concerned about. But we'll talk about that later. I mentioned also that there was something on the Republican side as far as concerns about the results. And I want to try to get to this. I want to try to make sense of this. Has been out there on CNN and elsewhere. But so I'm trying to stitch together the pieces of what actually happened here, as it has resulted in Donald Trump declaring the entire Iowa caucuses stolen. Okay, so here's what seems to have happened. On Monday, during the Iowa caucuses, Chris Moody of CNN had tweeted that Ben Carson would not be going to New Hampshire and South Carolina. The exact tweet is, Carson won't go to New Hampshire, South Carolina, but instead will head home to Florida for some R&R. He'll be in D.C. Thursday for the National Prayer Breakfast. And then, and it's unclear which came first, Ted Cruz's campaign or Steve King, a congressman from Iowa who is a surrogate for Ted Cruz. But Steve King tweeted, and remember him, he's the guy who famously, that illegal immigrants are crossing the border with
calves like cantaloupes.
Cantaloupe, that's right.
Calves, smuggling drugs.
Smuggling drugs, so they have calves the size of cantaloupes, whatever crazy thing that was. Anyway, he tweets, Carson looks like he's out. Iowans need to know before they vote. Most will go to Cruz, I hope. That was his tweet on the day of the Iowa caucuses. Now, the Cruz campaign saw either that or saw the CNN report in response on Monday. The Cruz campaign then sent out an email to their caucus captains around Iowa while the caucus was in process, This was from staffer Spence Rogers. He sent precinct captains an email suggesting that Ben Carson planned to leave the race, despite the fact that Carson's campaign had said that he would continue. He wasn't leaving. The email said, sent to Cruz captains at the precincts in Iowa, said, "Breaking news. The press is reporting that Dr. Ben Carson is taking time off from the campaign trail after Iowa and making a big announcement next week." That's what the email said. It was acquired by CNN. It went on to say, "Please inform any Carson caucus goers of this news and urge them to caucus for Ted Cruz." Now, Larry Ross, a spokesman for Carson, insisted in a statement that Carson was, quote, not suspending his presidential campaign. He said it was stronger than ever. He said after spending 18 consecutive days on the campaign trail, Dr. Carson needs to go home and get a fresh set of clothes. He will be departing Des Moines later tonight to avoid the snowstorm and will be back on the trail on Wednesday. We look forward to tonight's caucus results and then to meaningful debates in New Hampshire and South Carolina. Carson has decried what Ted Cruz did as a dirty trick. He said, "This is really a dirty trick. This makes me more determined than ever to keep going." Now, you got to keep in mind that anyone who would think, oh, Carson is out, anyone who would support Carson but want to make sure that their vote counted for somebody who was going to stay in the race, they would be, quite frankly, likely to move to Ted Cruz. Also, you know, appealing to the evangelical voters up there in Iowa. So Cruz's campaign defended the original email message that was sent out to precinct captains, and that was, frankly, erroneous because he hadn't said he was getting out of the race. He hadn't said there would be a big announcement next week. Cruz's campaign said, what did they say? They defended the message, said, "Carson said he was taking time off to go home. We simply repeated what he said. Our email simply stated the facts." When they were asked what that big announcement next week was supposed to refer to, they did not respond to CNN. Carson told Fox News that his wife Cindy was left to Candy was left to correct the campaign's misinformation coming from Cruz. She spoke at one of the caucuses apparently, and said, "No, we're not quitting." And apparently, Ben Carson ended up winning that particular caucus. And now Carson is demanding an apology from Cruz. Cruz said, well, it was a mistake. At first, he didn't want to apologize. Now he's apologizing, but he's not going to fire anybody for it. So Cruz is refusing to fire anybody for this. Carson says it could have made the difference. And in fact, there was, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but about 3 or 4 points between Ted Cruz in first place, Donald Trump in second place, despite Donald Trump being ahead in the polls, most of the polls going into Iowa. So if 3 or 4% of the voters peeled off from Carson and moved on up to Ted Cruz, well, that could have made the difference. That could have dislodged Donald Trump from a first place finish. Well, that's what Donald Trump certainly thinks. On Wednesday, he went on a tweet storm after Tuesday night when he called what Cruz did. He called it dirty. He called it a disgrace to the Hill. And then on Wednesday, Donald Trump tweeted, "Ted Cruz didn't win Iowa. He illegally stole it. That is why all of the polls were so wrong. Annie Y," that's what it says, "Annie Y, he got more votes than anticipated. Bad." Well, he deleted that tweet, Donald Trump did, and he replaced it, correcting the typo, removing the word illegally. He said, "Ted Cruz didn't win Iowa. He stole it. That is why all the polls were so wrong and why he got far more votes than anticipated. Bad," said Donald Trump. And then he said, "During primetime of the Iowa caucus, Cruz puts out a release that real Ben Carson was quitting the race and to caucus or vote for Cruz." And then Donald Trump tweeted that he brought up another issue, which frankly is almost as troubling, if not more so. He said, "Many people voted for Cruz over Carson because of this Cruz fraud. Also, Cruz sent out a," all caps, "voter violation certificate to thousands of voters." Trump went on to say, "The voter violation certificate gave poor marks to the unsuspecting voter, a grade of F, and told them to clear it up by voting for Cruz. Fraud, Donald Trump repeated. So that was today. This was Donald Trump on a tweet storm saying he didn't lose after all. It was stolen from him by Ted Cruz. And in fact, a notice was sent out to voters that said, you are receiving this election notice because of low expected voter turnout in your area. Your individual voting history, as well as your neighbors, are public record. Their scores are published below, and many of them will see your score as well. Caucus on Monday to improve your score, and please encourage your neighbors to caucus as well. A follow-up notice may be issued following Monday's caucuses. A scary note, to be sure, and one, frankly, that I have seen from other Republicans put out in years past, telling them, we know who's voting. We know your voting record is public. You better show up and vote. And, of course, it scares the hell out of them. Is it illegal? I don't know. Apparently, the Iowa Secretary of State, Paul Pate, said that Cruz's campaign had misrepresented state law with this letter. So we'll see. It could be investigated. It could be a campaign violation in Iowa. Trump was asked whether he was going to file a formal complaint against Cruz in Iowa. He said, yes, I probably will. What he did is unthinkable. He said the man had just left the race, and he said it during the caucus. The problem with politics is it's so dishonest, Donald Trump said when he was pressed about whether he would actually file a lawsuit. It remains to be seen whether he will actually file a lawsuit. Trump went on to say that Cruz was already, quote, under investigation for the voter violation mailers. We'll see if that is true or not. Don't yet know. Cruz, meanwhile, has been largely unapologetic. He has failed to he apologized for the mistake, but he has failed to fire anybody. In response to Trump's accusations, Cruz spokesman Rick Tyler told CNN that Trump was merely trying to get attention. The reality hit the reality TV star in Iowa, so nobody is talking about him now, says the Cruz spokesman. He's just trying to regain some attention on Twitter. Maybe. But maybe there were some, I don't know if I would call this fraud. Certainly some dirty tricks. Certainly some hardball. And politics, as they say, is not beanbag. My thanks today to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, to Mayor Cindy Lerner of Pinecrest, Florida. We will be back with you, same Brad time, same Brad channel tomorrow. Until then, drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com or follow me on the Twitters and the Facebooks at The Brad Blog. All right, that's it. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Everybody.